To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. Standing in solidarity with immigrants. So, what would universal access to healthcare look like for them?
If they don't get treatment, especially for treatable diseases, and they one day do qualify for benefits, we would want them as a society to be as healthy as possible so that in the end, economically at least, they won't cost our society more in the future.
Also, community colleges have become a battleground. Should undocumented students be able to enroll? We check in on North Carolina's community college system.
I mean, it's almost been 3 years since I graduated, and everything seems to be going down instead of up.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
This is news from Latino USA. I'm Angela Maldonado. In Honduras, Amnesty International says the country's interim government is using excessive force against protesters. Interim President Roberto Micheletti has said the government will not tolerate disruption in the streets. 2,000 protesters gathered outside the U.S. Embassy demanding the Obama administration take a stronger stand against Micheletti's government. In interviews with protesters, Amnesty International monitors report military and police shouting in support of the beatings. Police have released a statement that they try to negotiate first and use force only in extreme cases, citing an example where demonstrators burned buses, businesses, and attacked officers. The U.S. has already suspended millions of dollars in aid to the country, and ousted President Manuel Zelaya has called for trade sanctions, as the U.S. is Honduras' biggest trade partner. New numbers have been released on the number of journalists killed in Mexico. 52 journalists have been killed in the past decade, most deaths remaining unsolved. José Luis Soberanes, the head of Mexico's National Human Rights Commission, didn't say who was behind the killings, but drug cartel members have frequently targeted members of the media in the past. More than 11,000 people have died from drug-related violence in Mexico since 2006, and several media watch groups have listed Mexico as the most dangerous country in the Americas for journalists. In U.S. news, Justice Sonia Sotomayor cast her first vote on the Supreme Court. She dissented, along with Justices John Paul Stevens, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen G. Breyer, on a death penalty case from Ohio. The full court turned down the last-minute appeal from lawyers for Jason Getzey on Monday by a 5-4 vote. Getzey, convicted of a murder-for-hire killing, was put to death by chemical injection Tuesday morning. The Ohio Parole Board voted 5-2 that Democrat Governor Ted Strickland grant clemency to Getzey because sentences given in the case were inconsistent. The dissenting justices offered no reason other than saying that they would have granted Getzey's application for a stay of execution. In Washington, U.S. immigration officials discovered the records of 10 immigrants who died while in custody since 2003. Of the 10, 8 were from Cuba and 1 from Ecuador and Mexico, respectively. Jillian Brigham, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency spokeswoman, said the deaths didn't show up during a previous comprehensive search of immigrants dying in custody. A further review of records will now be conducted. The American Civil Liberties Union has called on the White House to enforce standards that ensure detainees receive medical care while in custody. The government can have up to 400,000 immigrants in county jails, detention centers, or for-profit prisons waiting for deportation. With the 10 deaths, the total of detainees dying while in custody rises to 104 since October of 2003. In Texas, a federal judge has upheld the University of Texas at Austin's consideration of race in its admissions program. Two white students filed suit against the university after not being admitted, they say, because of their race. The suit was an attempt to challenge the 2003 Grutter v. Bollinger case. The Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund wrote a friend-of-the-court brief in support of the university. David Hinojosa is a lead attorney for MALDEF. He says this case can serve as a model for other universities.
Universities are simply trying to do what's best for their students and what's best for, you know, society in general. I think that it definitely provides a path for other universities to be able to adopt race-conscious affirmative action plans.
Lawyers for the plaintiffs have said they will appeal the ruling. Finally, spoken word artist and Chicago native Maya Del Valle has made Oprah Winfrey's first ever power list. The list is published in the current Oprah magazine, O, and includes 19 other women from fields ranging from politics, finance, science, and the arts. When the magazine asked Del Valle what she did, her poem started out a little something like this.
When I would wander into the kitchen for the third time in 37 minutes, shoulders curved into a question mark, waiting for the perfect opportunity to ask her for something, my mother, in all her motherly wisdom, would say, "As if I didn't carry you for 9 months and push you from this body, what is it you want, girl?" El que no habla, Dios no lo escucha. If you don't speak, God can't hear you.
Del Valle has been a regular on Russell Simmons' Deaf Poetry series on HBO, and in May she was invited to perform at the White House. That's news from Latino USA. I'm Angela Maldonado. For more news alerts, visit us at latinousa.org.
It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This month on the program, we're looking at the multifaceted topic of healthcare for Latinos. We say multifaceted because it would be a mistake to think of Latino healthcare as a monolithic topic. You have recent immigrants to the United States, both those with or without immigration documents, and you have Latinos who are not immigrants at all, those who have lived in the U.S. even before it was the U.S. But today we're focusing on immigrant Latinos, and to help us sort through some of the issues is Dr. Kevin Minder. He's the executive director of the Center for Immigrant Healthcare Justice, a nonprofit educational organization based in St. Louis with a mission to raise awareness of issues affecting the health of newcomers to America. Kevin Minder, welcome to Latino USA.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's begin with legal immigrants to the United States, people who are here, came here legally, have proper documentation. What's their situation in regards to health care in this country?
Well, when you're talking about lawfully residing persons in the United States, you know, we have an employer-based health care system. So those immigrants that are coming here on visas that are working for companies that supply health care tend to do very well, and they're covered under the insurance that their employers offer them. Of course, we know that there are lawfully residing immigrants that come to the United States that in some cases lose their job or in some cases also might find themselves with an employer that for one reason or another can't afford to offer health care to their employees. And a problem, especially with these immigrants, is that in most states, there's no safety net for them.
Even though they're here legally, there's no safety net for them.
Yes. Currently in the legislation regarding Medicaid, which is one of the large safety net programs in the United States, there's a federal ban against offering Medicaid or providing federal monies to states to offer Medicaid for those immigrants that have been here less than 5 years. And so lawfully residing persons who are here and are paying taxes at the same rate as citizens aren't entitled to the same benefit should they fall into poverty.
Can you just stop there for a second and help us to understand? This was something that happened more or less around the year 1996 with the Welfare Reform Act. But help us to understand the logic of denying Medicaid benefits to legal immigrants who are, as you say, paying taxes, have every legal right to be here, but they're denied this kind of safety net. What's the logic?
Well, I think fundamentally, under the Clinton administration, when this law was passed, the objective was to try to save money. And what they were able to do with the passage of this legislation was to say that sponsors of these immigrants that are coming to the United States would be directly responsible for their health care. And so, for instance, employers who are given special visas to bring people over have to indicate that they'd be willing to pay for the health care of these individuals. The same is true for family members who bring other family members to the United States.
All right. Now let's talk about immigrants who come to this country with no documentation. And there is a perception out there that these undocumented immigrants are flooding into the healthcare system and essentially depleting it. First of all, is that true? And second of all, what is the reality that these undocumented immigrants face when they're in this country and looking for healthcare?
People believe that these undocumented persons are flooding our emergency rooms and are taking up resources in our hospitals, et cetera. But the facts simply don't bear that out. Less than 9% of immigrants that are in the country less than 5 years use our emergency departments. That's the lowest sector of the population. 22% of native-born citizens use the emergency department. So there's a large gap there, even though we know that the undocumented tend to be among the most economically disadvantaged people in our society.
And this is a good thing or it's a bad thing when you think about people who are sick and may need care but aren't going to get it? What ends up happening to them? And how does that affect the rest of us?
If you assume that the undocumented people that are in our society intend to stay here, then our objective as a society should be to see that these are the healthiest people we can have and the most productive citizens we can have. Because if they don't get treatment, especially for treatable diseases, and they one day do qualify for benefits, as we know in time, most of these undocumented people will have status. We would want them as a society to be as healthy as possible so that in the end, economically at least, we could say that they won't cost our society more in the future. But that's just an economic argument. The real argument, of course, is a moral one, which says that as a society, shouldn't we be concerned that every person who's in our society has the opportunity to grow and develop as a fully developed person? We know that there are a lot of industries that depend on healthy immigrant labor for their very survival as an industry. And it's to everybody in society's benefit that these people have access to quality health care.
Kevin Minder, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and sharing your thoughts.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Kevin Minder is the executive director of the Center for Immigrant Healthcare Justice. He spoke with us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. You can find more information about the center on our website at latinousa.org.
I watch and listen as the Obama administration, Congress, and health experts decide how to reform our healthcare system. And I think back to what happened to me 3 years ago, my very own personal encounter with a healthcare system in two very different countries, the U.S. and the developing country of Guatemala.
A personal essay from Maria Emilia Martin of Gracias Vida Productions.
A few months before I went down to Guatemala to work with indigenous journalists, I had gone to the emergency room of a well-known Northern California hospital with a bad abdominal pain. The doctors there diagnosed a hernia, but said there was no need to operate yet unless I also wanted gastric bypass surgery. There seemed to be a lot of pressure to have gastric bypass. Apparently, it's a moneymaker for hospitals. I resisted. They told me that a simple hernia operation could wait, even if I were traveling out of the country. On the trip to Guatemala, a few weeks later, the hernia became incarcerated. I needed to be rushed to a Guatemala City hospital from the provinces. I remember being taken into the emergency room, one that did not at all look like the one on ER or the one I'd visited in California a few weeks before. No shiny state-of-the-art medical appliances. Everything seemed kind of gray and bare and, yes, old. Then I was given anesthesia. I counted back from 10, and the next thing I knew, it was a day later. The surgery, they told me, had gone well, but there were complications, a pulmonary embolism, and later an intestinal bleed. These conditions kept me in intensive care for 3 weeks. A depressing experience, you'd think. Actually, I remember it as a time when I felt very well taken care of, even though I was far from home. I did not feel alone. My doctors would come and hold my hand. I'd see them conferring about my exams. The nurses were sweet and comforting, and somehow I never lacked for visitors. There was another surprise, the bill. 3 weeks in intensive care, $33,000. Compare this to my visit to the emergency room in California for just a few hours. That came to more than $12,000. getting back to the States, I had a relapse and had to go back into the hospital, a bright, white, shiny place full of the latest medical wonder machines. But unlike Guatemala, neither the doctors nor the nurses held my hand. Worse, it seemed as if my doctors did not communicate with each other. The gastrointestinal specialist didn't speak to the surgeon. I felt as if I were entering an entirely new medical universe each time I spoke with another specialist. I began to miss the sight of my Guatemalan doctors, conferring at least once each day in the corner of the ICU unit, going over new x-rays and test results, then coming in to take my hand to explain what was going on. Not all Guatemalans receive the kind of private hospital care I did, of course, so things aren't perfect there either. But as this country's leaders begin to seriously grapple with fixing the out-of-control monster that is healthcare in this country, I urge them to learn the lessons of my experience. Perhaps it's the human touch that is just as healing as those very expensive diagnostic machines. Try holding a hand once in a while.
Maria Martin is an independent journalist and the founding producer of Latino USA. She directs the Gracias Vida Center for Media based in Austin, Texas, and Antigua, Guatemala. Now, besides the emergency room and the hospital clinics, etc., another place where there's a battleground emerging in the immigration debate is the college classroom, specifically the community college classroom. In North Carolina, over the past 2 years, the state has changed its policy to first allow undocumented immigrants to enroll, and then they ban those same students just months later. Reporter Ligia Navarro went to North Carolina to see how the political back and forth is being lived out by the students.
When Jennifer was a senior in high school in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 3 years ago, she pretended she was heading to a four-year college, just like everyone expected her to.
In 12th grade, everyone was planning, oh, I got accepted here, I got the scholarship. I would even lie to them and be like, oh, I'm going here, just so they wouldn't ask me, you know, why aren't you going to school? Like, I would say I'm going to UNC and just pick a school far away so they wouldn't know.
Jennifer's secret was that she's undocumented, and she worried if her classmates knew she was going to community college, the only place she was accepted and could afford without financial aid, they might guess why. After all, Jennifer had always been a school star growing up. The student teachers encouraged other kids to hang out with, so that some of her drive might rub off on them.
Most of our Latino students at that point were either not graduating from high school or they were just graduating and going to work.
Greg Meyer runs a mentoring program in the Chapel Hill schools and has known Jennifer since she was in high school.
There were very few students who had attained the level of success that she had because it was still a relatively new immigrant population. And so she was one of the first kids who would have started our schools in elementary school and made it all the way through. For all intents and purposes, she was an American kid.
But while Jennifer might have seemed like an American kid, for many in her community, immigrants like her were outsiders who shouldn't have access to public services like schools. Paul Cuadros, a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, says that the rapid demographic shift from immigration has caused anxiety among some North Carolinians.
You know, you live in a small town, people know each other, and they've known each other for generations, and then all of a sudden you get this whole new group of people who don't speak the language, you don't know who they are, you don't know anything about them. And for the long-time residents, you know, that is a frightful thing. You know, Mayberry is not looking like Mayberry anymore.
We're listening to a report from Ligia Navarro from North Carolina. Her story continues on Latino USA in a minute. No se vayan. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Back now to Ligia Navarro's story on undocumented immigrants and community colleges in North Carolina.
Before the 1990s, when Jennifer's family arrived, North Carolina had very few immigrants. But by the beginning of the decade, the state's poultry and agriculture industries had begun heavily recruiting workers from Mexico, both legally and illegally. News spread that North Carolina was a good place to work. Initially, mostly men came from Mexico, and then Central America. Back then, Latino kids like Jennifer were an anomaly. But a few years into the wave of migration, men started bringing their wives and families. Soon the state's Latino population exploded, and according to Paul Cuadros, that's led to an anti-immigrant backlash.
The climate currently is still a little bit raw and angry, and there's so much misinformation out there with regard to the migration of Latinos to the South that they invent and hold on to various myths about this community and use it to sort of drive their anger. Things like, oh, you know, they're not paying taxes, they're going to increase crime.
One of the state's main anti-immigrant groups is Americans for Legal Immigration, which has now gone national. William Gein, the group's president, refused to talk to Latino USA, but here he is speaking in Hazleton, Pennsylvania in 2007.
Illegal aliens have broken a series of laws. They broke the law when they crossed the border. They broke the law when they stole your identity, wrecking your life. They broke the law when they took a job they weren't supposed to have and made a lawbreaker out of their company. These people have shown a pattern of disrespect and a pattern of criminal behavior coming from gang rule areas where there is no law.
The admission of undocumented students into community colleges has become a major issue for groups like Americans for Legal Immigration. But before 2007, the issue didn't receive much public attention. Some individual colleges even allowed undocumented students already. Then, in November 2007, just before retiring, former college system president Martin Lancaster ordered all colleges to admit undocumented students. For the first few weeks, no one outside the college system noticed, until groups like William Gein spread the word, says former community college system lawyer David Sullivan.
My assistant, bless her heart, she took phone calls from the time that she got into the office in the morning until the time she left in the afternoon, almost nonstop. Her voicemail would fill up. The calls were incredibly negative.
Soon, conservative talk radio covered the story for hours a day, encouraging listeners to write to their legislators and call Sullivan because he'd actually written the policy.
There was also a lot of hate. Some of it was directed towards me in particular, suggesting that I had in some way violated my citizenship of the U.S. and I should be expelled or sent to jail. There were times where I even felt personally threatened by what was being said on the radio stations and the phone calls we were receiving. And it frightened me. It frightened me for my family.
Shortly after the firestorm, the system president retired. 6 months later, with the new president in charge, the system board decided to ban all undocumented students, other than 100 or so who had enrolled in those 6 months. And while the community college system received hundreds of letters about the controversy, only a third were in support of undocumented students.
This was a real victory on the part of the restrictionists or the nativists.
Again, University of North Carolina professor Paul Cuadros.
They had already sort of gotten a toehold of the situation and were able to hold the politicians' feet to the fire during the election year and to get even Democratic candidates to pledge that they would not open the doors to undocumented students.
One of the members of the community college board at the time of the ban was Bev Perdue, a Democrat who was elected governor last year. Here's one of her 2008 campaign ads against fellow Democratic candidate Pat McCrory.
Hey, Henry.
Hey, Bill.
What you doing?
Oh, about to have some lunch. Just opened a can of chili con carne. Care to join me?
Sure. A little Mexican sounds good.
Huh. Maybe I should invite that Pat McCrory over, too. Have you heard what he said?
Oh, I know. I read about it. McCrory said it's good that illegal immigrants are here because they're building a lot of our buildings right now.
Does he think he's running for governor of Tijuana or something?
You know, McCrory's even against having a minimum wage for American workers.
That's crazy. I wonder how you say crazy in Spanish.
I believe that's loco.
Well, we'd be loco to vote for Pat McCrory.
That's right.
Well, now let's go get us a big bowl of chili.
This is Bev Perdue, candidate for governor, and I sponsored this ad.
Amidst the politics, students like Jennifer are stuck in limbo. But Jennifer's one of the relatively lucky ones. She enrolled before the ban took place, so she was grandfathered in and allowed to keep studying. But because of the economy, she sometimes has to drop out for a semester to help her parents financially. Jennifer hopes President Obama will change immigration policy to legalize people like her, but it's often hard for her to stay positive.
I mean, it's almost been 3 years since I graduated, and everything seems to be going down instead of up.
She tries not to think much about the future or harbor any resentment towards her parents for bringing her here.
I used to think, like, maybe if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be going through this, but I can't imagine being in Mexico and thinking about having 5 kids and not having a job, not being able to at least feed them. I think that it would be, like, the worst thing that I could ever do to have resentment for them.
Jennifer's high school Spanish teacher, Selena Jimenez, says that of the 18 Latino kids she taught in Jennifer's class, Jennifer is the only one still working on her education.
I see them lose hope. I see them not come to school because they can make $15 an hour. And they ask me, well, why should we come to school? You know, we're going to get a diploma. Whoop-de-doo. What can we do with it? Put it on the wall. That's it.
In the end, says Professor Paul Cuadros, anti-immigrant groups are punishing immigrant children rather than the companies whose jobs lured their parents here.
The most powerful player in this equation, they give a free pass to. They'll say things like, yes, and we should really go after those employers and we should put them in jail. But there's no real movement to do that. Instead, the movement is to round them up and the workers and to try and deport them or keep their kids out of school.
North Carolina's community college system is still on standby regarding a policy for undocumented students. In recent months, it released a study saying that the out-of-state tuition paid by undocumented students actually subsidizes the education of resident students, but have made no move to lift the ban. For Jennifer, things are starting to look up. She just won a $53,000 scholarship to finish her education at a 4-year college. But the news was bittersweet. Her younger brother, who graduated from high school this year, also applied for the same scholarship and lost, so he's thinking about joining the military instead. And even with a college diploma, Jennifer knows, there's still no guarantee she'll be able to work legally when she graduates. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, this is Lija Navarro for Latino USA.
And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Our report this week from North Carolina was supported by Columbia University's Hechinger Institute on Education and Media. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And by Lumber Liquidators, hardwood flooring for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD or lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.